Hi, Lee and Prasan. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you for having me, Bill. It's a pleasure to be on your show and talk about an issue that matters so much to me, transit equity.
Yes. Lee and Prasan is a researcher for the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He was first assigned to the Institute's Global Economy and Inequality team, his first research project centered around public transportation reform, as a means of pursuing race and class equity. This research ultimately produced a widely shared article about a successful free fare initiative, free transit fare initiative in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the title of the piece is "The Transit Equity Movement Wins Their Biggest Zero Fare Victory Yet." So, Liam, let's start with the need for more public transit and why it needs to be electricity-powered and free, and then we can discuss in the second half of this interview how to operate to get public support for building out the system. So first, Liam, in Albuquerque, enlarging public transit and making it free was driven by equity demands. So what do we mean by equity? And tell us the story.
Well, one big aspect of equity is, as we're building our cities, you know, denser, and as the populations of many previously smaller cities is getting bigger, we can't depend on car-centric infrastructure anymore. I mean, to begin with, car-centric infrastructure excludes those who either cannot afford maintenance of the car or cannot afford a car at all. The American Public Transportation Association estimates that, depending on your location, you could be spending anywhere between $12,000 to $17,000 yearly just in upkeep and gas just to own an automobile. And that could be in comparison with the cost of public transportation itself. So that's a lot. That can take up as much as 30% of the income for working class families. So from the very start, building cities around cars is an equity issue. And it's also an environmental issue. You know, the areas that will be hit worst with congestion tend to be in the environmental impacts of, you know, automobile building will be lower income neighborhoods. You know, the famous example is the way in which the Cross Bronx Expressway in New York impacted the lives of Bronx residents, and how Robert Moses built the bridge in a way to avoid the impact on the Upper East Side. But in general, just building more equitably, building public transportation, transportation is a lifeblood of a city. It connects residents to their resources, medical resources, educational resources, and community resources. You know, we talk about a crisis of loneliness in the United States. To build more connected communities, we have to have easier ways to get around. This is why the United States takes less commutes than other developed countries with more adequate ways of getting around easily.
Part of the problem, I think, is housing was made into a commodity and in very short supply. So many people have to wind up even paying 50% of their rent way out in some suburb without an automobile. It seems to me that so limits the lives of many, many, many millions of people here.
The housing issue and the transportation issue are inextricably linked. These are very connected from the fact that, you know, building public transportation, if not matched with an adequate housing policy, could actually raise rents in surrounding areas. They're inextricably linked. But there are some solutions across the country. There's talk about building new stations with high density, mixed use housing around it. That's good, you know, because we have to move past single family housing. I myself grew up in New York, so I grew up in mixed-use areas, and it's nice to be able to walk to a deli and not have to drive everywhere. So there's a quality of life standpoint as well, to not worrying about parking wherever you go. There's the equity, there's the environmental, but then there's also just quality of life from being able to live close to things that aren't just other single-family homes.
Right. You mentioned the environment a couple times. It seems to me there are two major environmental issues, at least. One, electrified transit replaces fossil fuel burning and is one of the absolute necessities in saving us from climate change. The second environmental problem that burning fossil fuels is on people's health. The air in cities is, in some cities of the world, lifespans are much, much shorter, like New Delhi or Beijing, for the unbreathable air that people are forced to breathe. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we don't even have to look as far as New Delhi. We could even look to Atlanta. You know, in the late 90s, it was deemed a non-attainment zone because of how bad congestion was. It was then that a lot of transit started to be expanded. It's not being expanded in an equitable way, but there's a real fight on the ground to make that happen. And the fight continues in Atlanta. But it's public transportation, particularly using electric vehicles, even without, you know, just having more people traveling in one bus. One bus carries so much more people than single individuals in a car. And it's just a more efficient way to get people around, reducing the amounts of greenhouse gas per trip. But if we can get that as low as possible, that's what we got to do ASAP to reduce the impacts of climate change, but also just to reduce the impacts of adverse health on youths growing up in the cities. You know, there is a measurable and rapid increase in quality of health in areas that have improvement to rapid transit. You know, this is both from the standpoint of the pollution of cars being reduced, but it's also from the standpoint of connecting them to health resources that would otherwise be harder to get to.
You know, on a human level, I think of the terrible air. It's not just high amount of carbon and dust. There's terrible air in huge pockets of our cities, particularly where the poor live, and that's expressed in the asthma rates. Very large,
absolutely.
Up to 20% of kids in that area have serious asthma problems,
mm-hmm.
and some of them die from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and people who live near these highways die sooner of heart disease and other bad air contributed to their early deaths. But that's how our cities were designed, and transportation systems, and especially, of course, the big sedan.
And the biggest thing about this is that it doesn't have to be this way, but we have to shift to a longer term mindset. You know, public transportation is going to be costly to build up, but once it's built up over the long term, the benefits will pay in many dividends for generations to come. I mean, if we look at, there's a lot of factors that go into Tokyo system being one of the few profitable systems, but it is, the government invested an immense amount into this system before they saw any kinds of profits. And it is cheaper than the New York subway. And I think the problem is that we stop short of funding it to the point where it can actually serve communities. That's why only 5% of commuters in the United States ride public transportation. Those 5% are often cluttered in areas like New York City that actually have pretty adequate public transportation. And there's a real mindset shift that needs to happen, because when we're spending on public transportation, we don't see that the result, the profits aren't going to come directly to the agency that's actually maintaining the transportation network. It's going to be seen in the community around it. There is if we were to invest over a 20-year period in public transportation, we would see $5 billion back for every $1 billion invested. And a lot of that is in increased productivity of being able to get to places without spending all this time parking. But most of it is in investments in businesses, in local businesses. And that ties into one of the big issues that we saw with COVID. You know, a lot of cities are experiencing a lot of failure with small businesses. It's difficult to keep the social and cultural fabric of many cities alive, because a lot of businesses that kept that alive are going broke. And one way to keep these communities alive is to just have more foot traffic, you know? And that brings me to free fares. The argument for why we shouldn't pay at the fare box, we should actually pay with our taxes, is that one of the major reasons cited for the 95% of Americans who do not ride public transportation daily is high fares. You know, they don't want to spend as much as they do now at the fare box. We already fund so much of these systems with our tax money. It's just going the extra step is more productive, because we spend so much money to actually make sure that people spend fares. We spend millions in New York to make sure that people don't hop the turnstile. But those millions could be directly going into funding the system, you know? If we just shift to a tax-funded system instead of a partially fair-funded system, because it really isn't mostly funded by fares,
there's a lot of
inefficiency.
It's very inefficient. More money is spent, at least I've read, in collection of the fare, enforcement of the rule, and safeguarding the money and the cash box and all of the rest of the stuff that goes into collecting money and then transferring it into accounts and all of the rest of it. It's an expensive proposition. And the expense of it in many places is much greater than the amounts that they're collecting. Just in the enforcement, you have to have people running around trying to stop people from jumping the in New York City, where I spend some time, in many stations, people wait outside the safety doors, but they're just to keep people forced into going through the money line. They're jumping the barriers. So there's an enormous amount of now in the city, and people open the doors when asked generally by people who are obviously not able to make the 275 fare. And I think that happens in a lot of places where bus drivers just don't want to be enforcement agents. And in fact, when they do, they have sometimes get disputes, right? And most attacks
in most disputes, most disputes with between passengers and bus drivers occur over fares, you know, because we're putting the bus driver in the position where they also have to police and administer fares. That puts a lot extra on their role, you know what I mean? They already have to worry about getting everybody safely from point A to point B, and now they also have to make sure that, you know, people are not skipping out on fares. That adds a lot more stress and unpredictability to the job. And that's why, going to the piece I wrote, there was a lot of bus drivers who supported free fares in Albuquerque. And as you mentioned, yes, in smaller systems, Albuquerque is a big city, you know, metro areas around a million, half a million in city proper. You know, it had a smaller and mostly an entirely bus system. During COVID, you know, the cost of administering fares was higher than what they were bringing in, you know, and that shouldn't ever happen. You know, that's just a massive inefficiency. There is a big problem, though, with when we switch to tax-funded instead of fare-funded systems, we have to ensure adequate funding. And that's where federal policy comes in. Currently, federal funding only accounts for 7% of public transportation allocations, only 7%. And that's because the federal government typically has only contributed to capital investments. That's a new bus, new rail, you know, that's new projects, but not really making sure that those projects are successful once they're up. That's the ribbon cutting stuff, you know, when you have the new station and it's all a celebration, but is it actually running, you know, every 15 minutes or is it every hour? You know, this is important. Is it actually connecting people with the resources that they need? And so during COVID, the federal government potentially set a new precedent because they started funding public transportation systems more directly, more completely to keep them alive through COVID. Because throughout the world, you know, most people were staying home, or there's a lot of people who had to keep going out and risking their lives just to keep putting food on the table or to keep, you know, everything running. So I don't mean to erase those people who kept society afloat during the worst years of the pandemic, but many people were staying home. Public transportation systems lost ridership, and it was really hard for them to recover. That's why we're seeing so many problems right now. They're still recovering. Even as ridership is up, it's not the same level. Because of remote work, it's not the same level. And that's why there's talk throughout the United States of budget cuts. That's the worst thing that we can do, you know? Just because the system can't pay for itself, it's unrealistic to expect the system to pay for itself. As I said before, the benefits are seen in the community, not in the transit agency itself. And yeah, it's also a great direct subsidy on working class Americans. You know, it keeps more money in their pockets. You know, a lot of people in Albuquerque who are struggling to make ends meet, but were using the bus to go everywhere, that saved them, you know, tens of dollars every week. And that goes directly into food and other essential things. So this is all important, but we have to make sure that we do it right. And it does, there's a lot that can be done at the local level, but there has to be change at the federal level as well. You know, only 7% is abysmal.
Yeah. Imagine if the U.S. wasn't funding its military so that it has more firepower and personnel than the next 10 countries combined, including China and Russia. Imagine if that money had gone into public transit.
And it would even take only a fraction of that money of the Pentagon's budget. It would take only a fraction of that to actually be able to adequately fund public transportation. You know, it's going to be slow. If we wanted to fix it all tonight, it would cost billions. It would cost hundreds of billions. But I don't think we can fix it all tonight, but we have to start fixing it tomorrow. You know, this has to start as soon as possible. If we're going to survive climate change, we have to speed up rapidly the clean energy transition. That begins with public transportation. As you're saying, our current infrastructure, which emphasized roads over public and active transportation. So active transportation being biking and walking, instead it emphasized roads. It's trapping everybody, forcing everybody into driving everywhere. You know, I have friends in Atlanta, which is a very car dependent city, who say, I would like to take the bus. If it was more reliable, I would like to take the bus and use that as a primary mode of transportation. It's not pleasant to drive everywhere and to lock myself into polluting the environment unless I can afford an electric vehicle. But yeah, you know, we're seeing a moment of you know, record-breaking infrastructure investments, the most infrastructure investments since Eisenhower, but not enough of that is going into public transportation. That's where it really needs to be going. We're stuck in the mindset of thinking that the car is the future. It is not. The future is in I love New York, but it doesn't have to be like the New York subway with rats everywhere. You know, we can put in the money to make this a good system, and we're going to see it pay off long term. As I said, 5-to-1 ratio. Every dollar put in, 5 out into the community. That's a massive money multiplier effect. So this is a really good way to strengthen local economies, reduce inequities in our society. As I mentioned before, you know, you save $13,000 on average trading out your car and taking for public transportation instead. That is, $13,000 is a lot, you know? So again, I said, it's a class equity thing. It's a race equity thing. People of color are far more likely to be taking public transportation than white people in the United States. And so this really hits a lot of bases at once. That's why, as I say, is that transportation is an everything issue, you know? It's race, class, environmental, and even just general quality of life for everybody.
Well, that's all for today. We're about to exceed our time limit. So to wind up, in my intro, I announced that Liam Crisan and I would discuss the need for a vastly expanded public transit system, that it became accessible to nearly the whole U.S. population. And that would greatly alleviate and reduce the multiple diseases and problems the current transit system causes. Thus, it would eliminate the 28% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions caused by fossil-fueled vehicles. It would clean the air and improve health and increase life expectancies. It would enable poor people who cannot afford autos and forced by ever-increasing rents to live in desolate communities. They could go to work and medical appointments, buy better food, and see families and friends. It would also save national resources by greatly reducing the need for cars, all that was covered today in today's interview. And in part two, we will show that the new public transit system can be successfully completed if our designers and engineers pay close attention to the challenges and potentials of local conditions. That part two will be coming up soon. So thanks, Liam Crisan, who recently wrote the article, "The Transit Equity Movement Wins Their Biggest Zero Fare Victory." Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.